Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
I remember George Michael taking a bit of a gentle dig at me. It wasn't bitchy, that wasn't that bad, but he just sort of said, oh, Mick's gone off doing his family thing. I have a streak of shyness that is very easily misinterpreted as arrogance because you keep a certain distance because you don't want to intrude on people, you know? Many of our friends, his friends at least, was saying that the best option was to put me in an orphanage, you know, or have me adopted. And not through any meanness, just thought they'd like, well, how can a man do that job?
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a man whose voice is instantly recognisable to anyone who had access to a radio in the 80s, 90s and noughties. He's been selling records, more than 60 million of them, for the last 38 years, having arrived in the charts back in 1985, with Holding Back the Years sounding from the get-go like a fully formed artist. Born in Manchester in 1960, he was an only child raised by his father Reg, a barber, after his mother Maureen abandoned the family when he was just 3 years old. It was an experience that later inspired him to write Holding Back the Years when he was a mere 17 years old. From there, as the frontman of Simply Red, followed enormous worldwide hits with Money's Too Tight to Mention, Stars and Fairground, as well as sellout tours on every continent, duets with some of the world's greats, and the accumulation of more gold discs than he probably knows what to do with. And now he's looking to add one more to his collection with the release of a new album. It's called Time. A father himself, he's now married to Gabriella and has been for 13 years, and they live with their daughter, Romy, in North London. So let's dial him up, shall we? It's Mick Hucknall. How are you, sir?
Well, good morning. Good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. Excellent. Really good. I didn't realise that, I mean, gosh, many a year has passed, Mick, since you and I have chatted, probably in some sort of corridor backstage at the Brits in the 90s, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise that you were such a wine buff in your kind of, you know, older years.
It's effectively a hobby, actually. So
you had a vineyard for a while, right?
Yeah. And then my wife fell pregnant and we decided that we didn't want to bring up our kid on the sunny slopes of Mount Etna. So we came back.
That's good.
Came back to the UK and my daughter Romy was born in Westminster.
Wow. So what made you want to come back?
Well, I'd not actually left. I mean, I've always been tax resident in the UK, but you know, because of at that time when we were members of the European Union, you were able to live anywhere in Europe without any problems. So,
yep.
We used to just, I spent some time living in Italy and then some time living in France. But I've, as I say, I've always been UK tax resident. So it's
yeah.
Not really like I left ever, really.
But the travels don't really stop. I mean, you have paused for quite some time, but you're back out on the road this year, aren't you? You're back across, got one UK day on the 5th of June at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, and then the whole of Europe. I mean, big venues as well, Mick. You're still packing arenas wherever you go.
Well, we have actually been touring on and off for the last couple of years because of COVID lockdown, we cancelled, I think, twice, possibly even three times. And so last year we were very busy, and the year before we were busy, less so, but busy. And this is really the culmination. I think this European tour now will be for a couple of months in June and July, and then I will take a break until 2025, which will be celebrating our 40th anniversary. So,
my goodness, Mick, 40 years.
Yeah.
Wow. That's something, isn't it?
It is.
There is not a lot of artists that can stake a claim to four decades in and out of the charts, playing to audiences year in, year out.
Well, I'm still alive. Most of my
despite the 90s.
Well, most of my contemporaries, well, I consider them contemporaries. Maybe they started a little earlier than me. Of you know, our industry has a lot of tragedy. You know,
when you
look at people like Prince and Michael Jackson, George Michael, all victims of either prescription drugs or illegal drugs, and I am still survive. I'm here. Pinch me. I'm still here. Fantastic.
And when you look back over the last four decades, I mean, so much has been done, achieved, travelled, experienced. And I just wondered if maybe we could dive into my first question and talk about time and timing more specifically. So are you ready for your first question, Mick?
Yeah.
Timing is often everything, be it in music or in life. And that was certainly true, for example, for Holding Back the Years, which took, I think, 5 years to become a hit. And then you juxtapose that with your own personal life. It was also the case when it came to your relationship with your wife, Gabriella. You'd had a two-year relationship, I think, back in the early 90s. It didn't work out. Met 10 years later and never looked back. You've been married for 13 years now. So why is timing so important, certainly in both of those cases? And when else do you think, Mick, that the expression, what's meant for you won't pass you by, has been true for you?
Well, I think it's a question of being ready for the things, the things that come your way. And in the first part of my career, I was touring, you know, for the first 10 years from 1985 to 1995. I was pretty much touring all the time. And touring is not conducive to a marriage. It's not conducive to a long-term relationship, really, because you've got two choices. Either your partner travels around with you, and what are they supposed to do all day? Or they stay at home, you don't see them for 2 months. So during that period, I just thought there's no point in even considering a long-term relationship at this stage. But anyway, as I got older, around about sort of 1998, 1999, I started to think to myself, well, you know, you've got to start getting yourself together. There's other things than just being famous and making music. You know, you want to have some kind of life outside of that. And I think if you don't have that meaning in your life, either if you start a family, there's a certain emptiness. You know? I mean, I remember George Michael taking a bit of a gentle dig at me. It wasn't bitchy, that wasn't that bad, but he just sort of said, oh, Mick's gone off doing his family thing, as he described it. I don't want to say that marriage and parenthood saved me, but it certainly gave me meaning in the second half of my life here. You know, I am more rounded and more, I don't mean that in a bulbous sense of being overweight, but I'm emotionally more rounded because I'm still learning. You know, the great thing about being a father and being a husband is that if you open up your mind and your heart, you're constantly learning stuff, you know? You're experiencing things about how to improve who you are and just keep pushing to make yourself a better person without trying too hard, you know? It's just a sort of, it's a natural kind of evolution as far as I'm concerned.
It kind of blows your mind, doesn't it? Because you're right in so many ways. I mean, first and foremost, I don't think I was ever prepared for the enormity, the rush of love, the absolute love affair of parenting.
Yeah.
And then the education piece where you're there to shape this little person. But yeah. as you're teaching them the basics, you're also pretty much reminding yourself of them. It's quite grounding in as much as it strips back.
But you've got to be
the bullshit, doesn't it?
You've got to be at the right, when you mention the word timing, it's got to be the right time for you. And I just speak from experience because early on in my career, and two members of the band at that time had children and we were away and they'd get a phone call saying, oh, she walked for the first time today. And we were in New Zealand, you know? And I just thought to myself, if I'm going to have a kid, there's no way I'm going to be away from home like this. It's just not going to happen. So when my daughter was born, I just said to my manager, look, I don't want to do this anymore. I need some time out. And however we handle it, I don't know when I'm coming back. You know, I have no idea when I'm coming back. But I'm definitely going to stop touring. And I'm not particularly interested in making records. And I'll see you when I see you. So that was, in essence, that was when we did the farewell tour. I think people, they got the, you know, Chinese whispers, you get the terminology all wrong. You know, the mainstream media said, oh, we were splitting up and I was finished with it. But I didn't, it was a hiatus. It was, I was saying farewell. Farewell is not goodbye. You know,
no, see you soon.
So I don't, well, see you soon. I didn't know when I was coming back. And because I wanted to devote my time. They always say about being a parent and the kids, the first 7 years are really important for shaping who they become.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be there, you know, and I was there and I have been there every day, you know, and it's a great feeling, you know. I mean, now she's independent enough to make her own breakfast, but, you know, for the last, at least 10 years, I've been getting up 7:30, making a breakfast, being the house chef, and just kind of living like that, you know, and it's been absolutely wonderful. These are the happiest times of my life, without doubt.
I hear everything that you're saying, Mick. I think, you know, those nights when you lie awake and you're trying to soothe an overactive mind, for me, it's the first 10 years of my son's life that I always revert to, because it was a honeymoon period for me. But I know that's not everybody's experience, but reading interviews with you as I researched this, I could feel the love you experience for family life and for your daughter through everything that you said and through all of the decisions that you've made. Actually, you followed your dad's kind of role modeling as a parent, didn't you? He kind of put everything to one side for you, and you've done exactly the same for your daughter.
Well, my father more so. My father was actually, as I reflect on it over the years, my father was incredible. You know, you're talking about somebody that held down a job. He worked actually 6 days a week with two afternoons off. He did all the housework. He did all the laundry. He did the house repairs. He did all the cooking. He did all the washing up. I mean, he wouldn't let me do the washing up. I don't know, you know, because I'm left-handed. He would stand over me and go, "You're not doing it right." So then he'd end up. So, you know, he did everything. I mean,
wow. And we have to remember the times that we're talking about here.
Yeah. Yeah,
there were not many single dads.
There were none
walking around.
There weren't any. you know.
No.
There were certain
widows, yes, but single dads,
yeah, there
not
weren't
so much.
Any, there weren't any in East Manchester, I guarantee you. but he just got on with it and had a very, very strong work ethic, you know. Many of our friends, his friends at least, was saying that the best option was to put me in an orphanage, you know, or have me adopted. And not through any meanness, just thought they'd like, well, how can a man do that job? How can, you know, that was the mentality in the 1960s. You know, growing up in East Manchester, for example, a woman, you were expected to be married before you were 24. If you weren't married before you were 24, there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And the thank God that these things have changed, you know, and the whole culture is so different than it is now.
Gosh, so your dad was encouraged to think about giving you up. I mean, this I should explain to the listener. Your mother had left when you were very young, when you were 3 years old. So your dad had to make this decision. How am I going to go forward as a parent? And he never remarried, did he? You never had a stepmom. It was just the two of you, which was very unusual for those times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I still don't know. I guess he just didn't have time for a relationship, you know, because he'd have to be home. It was the other thing about, I guess, what makes my character the way I am. Is that I'm very self-sufficient, and not having a mother, and having your father that's out working. So, for example, I would finish school at 3:30 in the afternoon. My father wouldn't come home until 7 o'clock at night. So I would go home to an empty house every day, and be on my own a lot throughout my life. So you learn how to be on your own. You learn how to do things on your own. And so between 9 and 11, I became self-sufficient. And that has held me in good stead over the years, because I love to have people around me, but I don't directly rely on people. I've always got that kind of backdrop where if somebody lets me down, I'm prepared to do it myself, you know, and it's just in your mind. I think also sometimes confuse. I also I have a streak of shyness that is very easily misinterpreted as arrogance, because you keep a certain distance because you don't want to intrude on people. You know, there's just a certain thing where, I'll give you an example. I was in Harley Street many years ago, and as I was walking into the doctor's, Sir Alec Guinness came out, and I was a huge admirer of Ealing, still am, of Ealing movies and stuff. And I saw him, and because of my shyness, I just couldn't say hello. I froze, you know. And sometimes when I keep a distance, people think it's arrogance, but it's actually an inherent shyness. And sometimes the weird thing is about shyness, you overcompensate the next time. You almost try too hard to associate with somebody. So then you're either completely over the top or you're nothing at all, you know, you're zero. So again, to go back to the early part, I just feel grateful to still be here, you know. There were so many moments in my early teens where I could have, you know, a lot of my friends ended up in Borstal or ended up later on in jail because we were doing things we shouldn't, and fortunately I got out, and it was art school that saved me when I managed to secure a place when I was 16 at Tameside College. And my life changed from that point on. That was the biggest moment of my life, in a way, at that point. Because without that, I really don't know where I would have ended up. But it wouldn't have been good.
Do you think that's because you were somewhere where you felt like you belonged?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there I was singing all the time. from being about 6 years old. Just, I used to get into trouble in class because I'd start murmuring and humming and you know, but no one ever told me I was a singer. You know, my father or my family friends, no one ever said, oh, you should be a singer. I just sang. And then when I got to art school, of course, it was a visual thing, but it was a home for a creative person. And so many of the artists of the 60s, musical artists, came out of art schools. David Bowie, Keith Richards, there's a long list of them, John Lennon, and who all used art school as a springboard to the next stage of their creative lives.
But it's almost like a pit stop, isn't it? It's somewhere where you can gather yourself and be understood, or at least tolerated, because you're talking about people that predominantly come from working class backgrounds.
Yeah.
Who the idea of a career in the arts, or a career even, something beyond a job, is fanciful. But also that the people you've just mentioned there, a lot of you have in common is the fact that in your teenage years, music was your friend. Lonely people, and music became your companion.
Absolutely. That was definitely the case in my early teens, when music was so important to me, as it is now even, but then it was
almost medicinal in terms of your mental health.
Absolutely. Yeah, without doubt.
Yeah. And because, I mean, you said nobody ever said to you, you're a singer, but can you remember a time when you weren't tuned into music and singing and it just being a part of you?
There has never been a time when music has not been with me. I mean, I used to, we had a family of babysitters. There was a group of, a family of four daughters who I'm still very much in touch with. And I used to sing for them. You know, I used to buy this magazine called Disco 45. And it had all the lyrics of the current hits. So I used to sort of sing these hits to these girls and their mother as part of their entertainment. You know, I'd go around and sing the songs to them.
They became like a surrogate family to you. They lived next door. They were your women, weren't they? They were the female steers through those childhood years.
Well, only for the first sort of 9 years, because once I was around about 10, just before I went to grammar school, they went off and had their own families, and I didn't really fit in at that point. So that was why, again, I was even more alone, because I didn't have them either. And I didn't want to intrude on them, because they were busy having their own families. And so that was what also made this emptiness more difficult in my early teens, was just not having anybody around at all. You know, you have three questions? We've wandered off.
Yes. Yeah. No, don't worry. This is the beauty of the show, is that we start with one and off it goes.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we've talked about timing. I'd like to dive into kindness for my next question with you, if that's all right, Mick.
Sure.
You gave a writing credit to your childhood friend, Neil Smith, on Holding Back the Years, even though you didn't write a word or a note of it. So I wondered if you could tell me what prompted you to extend such a kindness on that occasion, and when you've experienced maybe a similar act of kindness by way of karmic return.
Well, I love Neil. I've known Neil since I was 3 years old. We're still friends. And he and I used to write songs in my first band, the Frantic Elevators. We formed that band together. Mm-hmm. And we would get together on a Friday night and he would show me a song that he wrote and I would show him a song that I wrote. And then we'd go off to the pub and spend most of the evening talking about the Beatles. And that was kind of what we did, and we did it so we were so dedicated to it and so involved that when I achieved several years later my success, you know, I wrote Holding Back the Years when we were still in the Frantic Elevators and we were still in unit, and you know, he'd not had the success, or wasn't having the success I'd had. He'd had a rough time. It was really a reminiscence, actually. It was just like, well, look, I've had success with this, and now I'm going to give you a piece of that because of our past, just as a sort of a souvenir, like a memento of the experience we had together, you know? So...
Wow. It's a hell of a pension as well, Mick. You know,
that's true. He's done very nicely, and that's fine by me because I love him to bits.
How does that work then when you become, so, you know, you talk about how self-sufficient you had to be as a child because by virtue of the fact that you had a dad that worked long hours and no mother at home. How do you then open up into a family unit and stop being so self-sufficient, start to learn to lean on people like your wife, for example?
Well, that's the essence of it right there, is that that's the learning curve. That's the part you need to learn, because the person you're with wants to give you stuff, but you have to let them in. You have to give them the opportunity to. And so it's all well and good me being self-sufficient, but then that leaves the other person feeling empty in that they're not giving. So in the last kind of 15 years, that's been one of the most important aspects of learning is learning to consider the other person and to consider that they want to give as well, that
yeah.
You know, it's not just about giving to them. They want to give to you. So as I said at the beginning of the conversation, I feel, even though I'm 62 years old, that I'm still learning. When I don't feel set, I don't feel set in my ways. I just am open to experiencing anything that comes my way, especially from my family.
Well, maybe that is the kindness that, you know, the fact that you got there in the end, Mick, that you were able to learn to open yourself up to becoming a family unit of your own.
Yeah, and it's just wonderful. I mean, it really is wonderful.
You like being a dad, I can tell that.
Yeah, I do very much, yeah. I feel honoured. I feel kind of very fortunate.
Okay, time for your third and final question. I wanted to know about the song, the book, and the one object that could sustain you forever. If that's all you had in the world to go to, what book would you choose? What song would it be? What object would you hold on to, and why?
Well, that's a tough question. I think the song would have to be Holding Back the Years. It's so autobiographical. It's not something that I sit around playing all day. It's kind of who I am. So it's within me. You know what I mean? It's not like saying to somebody, play your, what would be your favorite song that you could take away on a desert island? That would be a different answer.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you phrase the question, I would have to say, well, that's kind of who I was, and in a way who I am. So I would choose that.
Do you remember where you were, Mick, when you came up with the lyrics and the melody? And
yeah, I was because... in my bedroom. I was in my bedroom in my dad's house in my bedroom, and I'd only just recently started to learn to play guitar. And I think I was just, I didn't even know three chords. I just was learning. And I just sat there and it just came out. Just incredible, really.
Those lyrics were so grown up at any age, let alone at that age. Was it the same with the lyrics? Did they just fall off the tongue?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Yeah. Now, to answer your question regarding a book, the book that comes into my mind is The Great Gatsby by Scott Fitzgerald.
What?
I love that book. I love the way it captures the era.
Yeah.
It has a melancholy to it as well, that it sort of represents the end of the first great musical movement in the 20th century, which is the jazz age. It just has this incredible mood to the book. So regarding the book, that's the first book that came into my mind.
Nice. That's a really nice suggestion. You're right. It's full of character and charm. It's almost a piece of social history as well, isn't it, when you read that?
Because
you are taken to the times in which it's set. And you're right, musically, there was quite a revolution happening in terms of science, the jazz movement, for example, which has gone on to inform so many other genres of music as a result.
Well, one of the things that I have a kind of bee in my bonnet about is that I don't think African-American culture gets the credit that it's really due. And when, at the beginning of that time, when you started out with people like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, without Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, there wouldn't have been the Beatles, which seems like a long grab. But when you really add it up, what they did was that they used Western instruments with expression.
Mm.
And no one had ever used expression before. Everything was notated as a piece of classical music. Mm.
It was uptight, wasn't it? Constrained.
Saxophone wasn't an instrument that you would use to talk. Solo instrumentation and solos in that respect weren't there before. The people played direct notation without expression.
Mm.
And that expression changed everything, and because people then could actually start bending notes.
Mm.
And that became more expressive in how a great example then, the next step would be Sinatra. And if you hear how Sinatra sings, he tries to tell the story, but he also plays with the notes. They're not written down. They're the expression. And that whole thing came about in the 20th century. It wasn't there before.
Mm.
That all came from African-American music. Without rock and roll, there wouldn't be Elvis. Without Elvis, there wouldn't be the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and all that music. Mm. Would never have sounded like that. So we owe a great debt to African-American music in the 20th century that shaped the way we dress, the way we speak, And I just want to always try and give African-American culture as much credit as possible, because without it, we wouldn't speak the way we do. We wouldn't dress the way we do. The music wouldn't sound the same. And it's an extraordinary contribution to global culture that seems to get ignored or seems to just be sort of swept under the carpet sometimes, I feel.
No, you're absolutely right. I think without it, we'd be culturally quite barren. When you talk about those artists, I don't know if this is something you've done with your own daughter, but I tried to sit down and, you know, when my son was getting to an age where he was showing an interest in music, and I wanted to expose him to heritage artists that I thought were brilliant educators, brilliant contributors. Have you ever done the same for your daughter? And if so, who are the artists that you've sat her down with?
Well, she's kind of discovered it herself, but she is an absolute Beatles fanatic. She knows every song. It's extraordinary. And also she loves Bob Dylan. So those are the two kind of artists that I think she really reaches out to. But she's voracious in searching for music. She loves jazz. And I'm not really promoting it anymore. She just kind of does her own thing. But she's not that interested in contemporary music, strangely. I've discouraged her. But she just is rather envious of people growing up in the 60s. She kind of wished that she was growing up then. Even though I say to her, it wasn't a bed of roses, especially for girls. You know, yeah. you wouldn't have had the opportunities that you have now. But nevertheless, I think it's more from a music and a cultural point of view in that respect that she really admires that era.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Good music lives on forever. And what about the one object that could sustain you forever, the one thing that you'd always keep close?
Well, that will bring me back. A bottle of wine. How about that?
Yeah. Let's do that. But it has to be a never-ending bottle of wine, because it's not going to last. It's not going to sustain you for long, Mick, otherwise.
Okay, well, I'll have the bottle there, and behind the bottle will be a very large barrel. And I can refill the bottle when necessary. Funny enough, I'm not a heavy drinker.
No.
I would describe myself as a moderate drinker, but it's probably because really good wine is meant to be savoured and you don't really glug it down. And so I've found over the years that having a passion for wine has actually moderated my alcohol intake, not exacerbated it.
Because it's given you a respect for it, do you think?
Well, I just enjoy tasting different things, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be expensive. If you can find really great wine these days at moderate prices, you know, many of the new world wines, places like Australia, New Zealand, South America, Chile, produce some beautiful wines that you don't need to be a millionaire to enjoy.
Yeah. What's your favorite, what's your go-to wine?
Well, if we're going to talk about white wine, I would say a bone dry Riesling.
Really?
I love Riesling.
Hear a lot of love for Riesling. And I mean, that was a big drink. I remember my mum drinking that a lot in the 80s. And then it just sort of disappeared.
It was very, in those days, it was a bit like that Liebfrau Milch.
Yeah.
It was very sweet.
Yeah.
And a Riesling Spätlese is a sweet Riesling, but I like them very dry, trocken. So it would be Riesling trocken. And I love the kind of crystalline dryness of it. And it feels like a kind of a alpine mountain stream. You know, it's got nice. That kind of freshness that I love. So I'm a big, big Riesling fan. I love to have it as an aperitif instead of champagne. The way the Germans have it, they tend to drink as an aperitif. But I love Riesling.
Your travels actually must have exposed your palate on every level to so much, be it culturally, you know, in terms of the food you eat, the wines you drink. You must have learned so much when you think about that young man that sat writing, holding back the years on three chords in his dad's bedroom.
I didn't drink wine at all until I was about sort of 24, 25.
Mm-hmm.
When I first experienced Italy, I think it was the first time I really thought, wow, wine is real interesting.
I also think if you're from working class stock, as I am, as you are, like, people drinking at home was just not a thing in the 60s and 70s. No. I mean, you went to the pub and had a drink. People didn't drink wine at home. That was for the upper classes.
My dad didn't even drink beer at the table. No, it was just, he'd have a cup of tea.
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking to me. It's been really nice to catch up. I look forward to the new album, Time, which you'll be playing. Just one show in the UK, June the 5th, Shepherd's Bush Empire. Tickets are available at simplyred.com, and you can get the album wherever you get your music.
And you, as I'm looking at you now, have not changed a bloody bit. You're the same. You look exactly the same. Some of what you've got.
I'll tell you what it is, Mick. 2 ring lights. That's it.
Well, you know, that's why you can't look at me. I don't have those.
And if you're in the mood for more great conversations with other great vocalists, we've got episodes with Skin from Skunk and Nancy, Islands of Melda May, she's brilliant, Gary Barlow, Steps, Danny Minogue, All Saints, Delta Goodrum, Louise, Hanson, Travis and Charlene Spiteri in our back catalogue. And good news, don't forget, we've started dropping a brand new mini midweek episode every Tuesday featuring some of the best bits from our best guests. It's called Something from the Cellar. Vintage cuts served to your feed every Tuesday afternoon. So make sure you don't miss a moment of them and make sure you're following the show. Just hit the follow or subscribe button. I'll be back Friday with a brand new guest. Until then, thanks for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.